Before we begin our dialogue, I've asked Sadia to share a recitation from the Quran, and then she'll give you the English translation.
Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be upon you, and thank you for having me here today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wal asr, inna l-insana lafi khusr, illa alladhina aminu, wa aminu salihat, wa tawasaw bilhaq, wa tawasaw bil-sabr. And that translates to, I begin in the name of God, the most merciful, the most compassionate. I swear by time, verily man is in the state of loss, except those who believe and do righteous deeds, and exhort each other to follow the truth, and exhort each other to observe patience. Thank you.
We're going to sit down over here. I'm going to let Sadia introduce herself in a couple of minutes. As I mentioned before, we were expecting Sheikh Umar to be here today, and he's really under the weather. I always worry about Sheikh Umar because he is so active, so involved in the community. He is always busy. He's always doing things. When I met with him last week, fewer than three people came to the door asking him about different things that he needed to be involved in. And we had a 20 or 25 minute meeting. He needs an administrative assistant. I think if you can work on that with the mosque, okay? He does need that. So, basically what our sermon series is, if you're new to this, is we started this a couple of weeks ago, and we're talking about the wisdom that other traditions bring us. This is kind of cool to just sit in the chair up here and talk. I like this. We might do this again on just some other topic. I don't know. But we're looking at the wisdom of other traditions. We looked at, Heather took us through Judaism last week a little bit. We're looking at Islam this week, next week Hinduism, and so on. And the purpose of it is not so much to find out the facts about, you know, what you believe and the five pillars and all those kinds of things. They all know that stuff, right? You all know the five pillars, right? You could name them off, and zakat and all that stuff, the hajj, and we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
But what we want to do is, in here, is maybe focus more on those things in your faith, in your tradition, that really can have an influence on us. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. One of the topics that we're going to bracket to the side, and I hope you're not terribly disappointed by that, is that we're not going to talk about violence, about religious violence, and all those kinds of things. That seems to be the topic that the media and a lot of folks really get hooked into whenever you talk about Islam. And so I always like to be about changing the dialogue, and so today I want to change the dialogue to talk about some other things. Sheikh Umar has been extremely outspoken on the topic of Islam as a religion of peace, and you can find multiple references out there in the media to statements that he's made, to talks that he's given about it. He's been in the newspaper. He talks, I know, at mosque services about that all the time. So we're going to kind of leave that out to the side today, and I hope that's okay with you all. So. But Sadia, why don't you take a minute and just tell us a little bit about who you are. And I noticed you have your Texas Impact badge on today, so.
I do.
Yeah, which is great. We're big supporters of Texas Impact.
Thanks. I'm not used to being mic'd in, so this is fun. I feel like a little like Taylor Swift or someone. thank you all for having me here. My name is Sadia Termizi, and I do work for Texas Impact. I'm the membership director there. So if you don't know about Texas Impact, come see me afterwards. But also, I've worked for IACT, the Interfaith Action of Central Texas, and have just been personally involved in the interfaith movement for about a decade now. And if you really dug into it, I've been involved in the interfaith movement all of my life, because as a Muslim in a predominantly non-Muslim community, you just get thrown into it. I was born in Pakistan, And my parents immigrated here in the early 80s when I was about the age of the kids who just performed the service. And I've grown up in Houston and Dallas and moved to Austin 14 years ago when I met my husband. And I guess I'm now a transplant of Austin's. Let's see, I guess that's about it. If I was raised Muslim and do have non-Muslim family members, and so also through that angle, I feel like I've been doing interfaith work all my life as having cousins who are who identify as Christian and Muslims, and we are courting a lovely Hindu man into our family currently with a cousin of mine.
Interfaith in your family.
Yes. It's all about the interfaith.
Did you say where you went to school?
Oh, I went to, I did my undergrad at UT Arlington in social work, and then I have an MBA from Houston, from Clear Lake, U of H Clear Lake. Let's see. And then I've just been sort of studying religion broadly on and off throughout my life.
Well, thanks so much for being here and for coming in for Sheikh Umar.
And I do want to say, I'm sorry I'm not Sheikh Umar, but I'm not a scholar, and so I will be speaking on behalf of myself as a Muslim American rather than from a scholarly perspective.
Well, we'll just have to have him back again. Okay. So, yeah, he owes us one.
He's great.
Okay. Well, we threw out some cards last week, and so the congregation had some questions, and so I'm going to kind of filter a few of those questions in. One question that pops up from time to time is when we're talking about God in the Muslim faith and in our faith, are we talking about two different gods or are we really talking about the same God?
Personally, I'm of the school of thought that the Muslims generally believe that our God is the God of Abraham. And so we believe we worship the same God as Christians and Jews and those who follow the God of Abraham. And more broadly than that, we also believe that, you know, God is one and God is all-encompassing. So I think regardless of what you call, what word or what name you use to apply to God, that we believe in the same creator of the world.
We have this strange thing that you, since you've been in churches before, you know about it, you probably have, you know, maybe it's called the Trinity, our understanding of God, that we kind of talk about God as
right.
Three persons. And one of the challenges that I experience from the Jewish faith and the Muslim faith is for us to get clarity about what we mean by God.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes we tend to talk about Jesus as if Jesus were God. That we talk about the Holy Spirit, and that we tend to almost talk about three gods at times, and so I appreciate that in your faith that you're very clear. The basic statement that you would say in the Muslim faith is what?
I testify that there is no God but God, and we believe that Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, was his final messenger.
Yeah, so that's pretty clear. Okay, thanks. So we're not talking about violence and all of the negative things so much. So I thought, again, I would just turn things a little bit. On the front of your bulletin cover, you notice the beautiful calligraphy that's on the cover. And we don't have screens, so we're not able to put up other kinds of things on the screens as far as like architecture and art and those kinds of things. But I was wondering, Sadi, if you would feel comfortable talking a little bit about the beauty of Islam. I mean, I think that when most people hear the word Islam today, that sadly they're going to think about bad things, about violence and terrorists and that sort of thing. And so I was wondering if you could maybe paint a little different picture of how you experience that, maybe in art or maybe just through the reading of the Quran.
Sure. Well, I was
going to
say, grew up here, and so Islam, for me, is different than Islam for somebody who's only ever been in Pakistan or the Middle East or wherever. And so I feel pretty privileged to be an American Muslim because I've been able to see the breadth of the diversity in Islam. There currently we're actually in the period of the Hajj, which is the pilgrimage to Mecca. And I haven't personally performed the Hajj, but my parents have and many friends have. And it's fascinating to hear from them that when you arrive there, you're surrounded by every color, every skin color, every ethnicity, every, well, not religion, but...
Sounds like General Conference in the United Nations.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah, a little bit like that.
It is a little bit like that. And so to for people who perform the Hajj, it's fascinating to see that Islam is so diverse. You have people from China and the Middle East and Australia, like every continent, every country. And as an American Muslim, I feel like I've had a little bit of an end to that, because in America we do get to see Muslims from all over the world. Whereas if you are have never left India or Pakistan, you probably have a very limited scope of what Muslims are. And so, I'm sorry, I'm kind of trying to get back to your, about the general arc. I mean, it's amazing to me because people will say, oh, tell me about your religious culture. And really, the fascinating thing for me is culture versus religion, because the religion, Islam is pretty much a unanimous religion, but it depends on where you're from, on how you apply it, and what your culture is. So, for example, even with the hijab, which I usually have a scarf on me, I don't wear it on my head, but I have friends who do. And even that, it's one of the things that, depending on how you were raised and where you were raised, many people choose to wear the hijab, and others choose not to. And even just that acceptance of one another, it's not often reflected on the media and in the news, because it's almost like all the images of Muslim women tend to be covered up. But in the real world, Muslim women dress like me and dress like my friend Luna, who's not here, who was going to demonstrate on Mahajba, a hijab-wearing woman. And people, depending on where they're from and what their comfort level is, will sometimes wear the complete burqa with everything but their eyes sometimes showing. And for me, as an American Muslim, I've learned to accept all of those views of a Muslim woman, because that's what Islam is about, is being able to acknowledge that we all worship differently, we practice and apply our faiths differently, and being, at peace with that and accepting each other. I don't personally am not an artist or very much into art, but the calligraphy that's on the cover of this is beautiful, and that is the traditional sort of artistic rendering that's commonly applied in Muslim countries, because we don't believe in showing people's faces as far as drawing people's faces. So you might have heard about the Draw the Prophet Muhammad contest, which often raises a lot of weird responses. And as an American Muslim, I would just say, while I don't appreciate someone trying to depict the Prophet, whom we personally don't depict, I have to say, at some point, we just have to let people do their thing and not engage in that, because it leads to inappropriate conflict. And I know you said, Reverend Alford, that you don't want to dive into violence and the negative aspects, but I think I do need to say that, unfortunately, that is what people often think about when they learn about Islam or hear about Islam. And as someone who's been brought up as a Muslim, it's so different from my version of Islam, which has been, I've been taught that it's a religion of peace. We do, as I shared earlier, I have family members who are not Muslim, and we get along great. I've dropped off my cousins to Easter services, and they've dropped me off to Friday services. And really, there isn't, the conflict that exists is a conflict that I see in pretty much throughout the world. It's a lot of it is politically based, a lot of it is just limited exposure to others. And so the Pew study research has done a poll that shows that Islamophobia currently is more, more people are afraid of a Muslim if they've never encountered one. And so, and I would say similarly, a lot of Muslims are afraid of the other, whatever that might be, because they've never encountered somebody who is Christian or Jewish or what have you. And a lot of their views are steered by what their media is and what their input is about that culture. I'm just going to keep talking.
Okay.
You jump in.
I'll jump in right now. So let's talk about something specific. Sharia law. Somebody had asked about that. You know a little bit maybe about the controversy in Irving, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're Texas Impact, about some of the laws that have been passed in Texas. It seems like there are a lot of people who are really concerned about Sharia law and what's that going to mean, and, you know, am I going to be like going down to the mosque and get like, you know, fingers cut off or something, or, you know, all kinds of crazy ideas about
sure. What
would be involved. And when I talked with Sheikh Umar, it sounds more like a tempest in a teapot. So what can you say about Sharia law to sort of ease our minds and help us understand better about what that actually is, as opposed to what we might conjure?
Right. It's fascinating because about 2 years ago, I never really thought much about Sharia law. It wasn't a thing that I woke up with the thought of, what will I do with my Sharia law practice today? And I still don't do that, but because of my work in Texas Impact and in just in general, the media, the term Sharia law has just become this hot button word term that's passed around. And I can honestly say my understanding, I've had to learn more about it so I can answer that question. And I'm not an expert, but just as with the U.S. Constitution and with law in general, and I'm not a lawyer, but I work with one. So, you know, legal rulings are constantly interpreted and reinterpreted and rethought, and that's how Sharia law is applied. It's basically not a set rule or a set book of law. It's the day-to-day application of Islam in the lives of Muslims. And that changes from whether you're living in a Muslim community. Sharia law might interpret things one way because that is the law of the land, or it may be just the generally accepted norms of that community. And so in America, when someone wants to know if, I'm trying to think, I remember I had a great example this morning in my head about Sharia law. Well, I've lost it. But, for example, if I decided that, you know, I'm not really that great at the five daily prayers because I have to be at work, and it's a little awkward for me to pull out my prayer rug and put on my hijab and offer my services, those are the types of day-to-day, situations that I would maybe go to my mom and say, this is something I'm struggling with. What is the Islamic ruling on it? And he would help me figure it out. And prayer is kind of an obvious one because, I mean, we do have to pray and we're expected to pray and figure it out. But even things like halal meat, which is a different schools of thought have a different concept of whether or not Muslims are required to eat meat that is slaughtered in a certain way, similar to kosher. It's the Muslim version of kosher meat. And so there are people, depending on your school of thought, who feel like I have to be able to find halal meat because that is the only kind of meat I can eat. Whereas other people in America, because it's not widely accessible, have to figure out, well, what is the Sharia ruling on the meat? Is there flexibility? And then based on your circumstances and, you know, if you live in small town Texas, and there is no halal meat available, your a mom might say, you know what, in this circumstance, it's okay because it's a hardship on you to try to find that. And that's sort of the day-to-day applicability of Sharia law. It's not something, I think the concept of Sharia law taking over America is such a, well, joke. But I guess it's just, it all comes down to being afraid of something you don't know about. And then having people in powerful positions stoking that fear and using it. Irving, for example, has had some situations with their mayor railing the community about the fact that there are Sharia courts. And it's really not that different from if you're Catholic and you want a divorce and you have to go through a canonical situation. I don't know the details of the Catholic Church, but I believe you have to have a priest and Catholic leaders help you navigate that. And similarly, if you're Jewish, there's the halakha, the law of their community, and rabbis help people in day-to-day situations navigate how they deal with everyday situations within the context of their religious rulings. And similarly, Sharia is something that if I, God forbid, were going through a divorce and I would want my imam to help guide me in that and maybe, you know, help mediate. And that's where Sharia law starts coming into the picture, is to say, what is the ruling, the Islamic ruling, and how do we apply it? So that's kind of in broad strokes what Sharia law is. It is not a law. It is a fluid a way of applying legal teachings and rulings in case-by-case examples.
I think Jake Boomer said that 90% of what he would call practicing Sharia law is what you talked about, marriage counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably the most common thing, yeah. You know, unfortunately, that people are going through, and they, more likely than not, people can navigate things like whether or not they want to go out of their way to access halal meat. But in the case of a marital dispute, child custody issues, they are more likely to turn to the imam for guidance. And that's where he gets pulled in a lot.
And that's why he has the flu. So, poor guy. When I was in Toronto, all the major grocery stores in Toronto had a section with halal meats in them. I mean, I was really impressed. Yeah,
right.
Like just the main grocery store you walk in. One of the things, speaking of halal meats, the opposite of that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Ramadan.
Okay.
Yeah, Ramadan this year was, so as I understand Ramadan, that's the, it commemorates when the recitation of the verses were given to the Prophet Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
And so this year it was from June 5th to July 5th. And that's like, I don't know if you all remember that time period very well, because we've had some cooler weather and some rain, but that was like the hottest time, rainy days and all that. Hot days and just long days. And no rain, very dry. And so we went over to an iftar, which is an iftar is the breaking of the fast at the end of the day. And I talked with a young Muslim woman, and she said that she got up at 4:30 in the morning to have her morning meal, and then no water or food for the whole day until 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night when we were at the iftar. And then the fast was broken with the eating of a date. And I said, how did you make it through this fast? And she talked about community, you know, the community that's there. And she talked a little bit about this spiritual side of it, that it's not just about not eating, that there's a whole spiritual dimension to Ramadan. So I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about kind of the spiritual side of Ramadan.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's Ramadan also just to, because I've had friends say, I don't understand, why does Ramadan keep jumping all over the calendar? But each year, Ramadan moves up by 10 to 11 days. And so through the course of 30-some years, there's math that can be figured out, but I believe it takes around about 30 years for Ramadan to pass through the entire, every month. And so I've experienced Ramadan in the winters, and now we're in the summer years, and gradually in a few more years, it'll keep keep moving up a little earlier and will be in the spring. So the fast begins at sunrise, and we, as Reverend Alford said, typically we'll break our fast at sunset with a date and some water, and then of course an actual meal. The dates are traditionally what was used in the Middle East, because they're really common and they're very, they've got a lot of nutrients and hydrating. But from the physical aspect, it's definitely a challenge. And as I said, when it was in the winter years, February fasts are awesome. And, you know, June and July fasts are also awesome, just in a different way. And but, you know, as hard as it is to do the physical fast, what helps is knowing that you're not doing it alone. Even if you, when I was in college, I lived in a dorm and my roommate was not Muslim. And so, in theory, I was waking up alone in the morning, putting some food in myself, you know, my body, and trying to make it through the day. But it helps to know that there are millions of Muslims around the world who are going through that with you. So being part of a community of Muslims, whether physically or even just remembering that there are other people who are doing this with you, really helps. And as I've no longer in college, it's been a long time, but as I've married, my husband's Muslim, it helps to have that community feel, that camaraderie. In the mornings when I'm not really quite a morning person. So at 4:30 in the morning when it's time to get up and eat, it helps to have somebody there who's like, hey, get up. Here's your coffee. So and then there are actually days when I'm the one who's like, hey, we're almost, you know, out of time. We want to eat quickly before we're running out of time, so get up and eat. So that camaraderie is a big part of it. And in the evenings, there's services. Every night, the mosque hosts evening services during Ramadan, the special Ramadan services. So it helps to be able to go there and, again, be in a community of people who are who can empathize with what you're doing. So that's the physical need, aspect of it. But I think one of my personal, I feel like every year when I'm fasting, I have little epiphanies, where I'm just like, wow, today I'm really thirsty. And I remember several years ago, there was a big campaign online going on about Ethiopia and parts of Africa that were having a major water issues, access to water. And I remember just really, for the first time in my life, getting it to a point where I was just able to say, oh my gosh. I mean, you can intellectually understand that water is important, but when you're fasting and your body is going through that dry mouth period, and then you're just like, wow, I know at the end of the day, I have access to clean drinking water, and I can drink to my heart's content. And yet there are people throughout the world who really just don't have that at the end of the day or at any point. So empathy is a big part of fasting, learning to acknowledge and, you know, walk in the shoes of someone else who doesn't have a meal at the end of the day, or who, another year I had my epiphany of that year was, at the time I was working with a program that helped youth, underserved youth in schools, in Title I schools, and, you know, sort of helping them with after-school programs. And I remember that particular night at the dinner table, there was tons of good stuff, and just thinking, wow, I've had a really hard day of focusing at work. I had a hard time focusing today. Really couldn't concentrate on that project that I was working on. And then suddenly it just dawned on me, that's every day for a lot of kids who don't have breakfast and don't have a good dinner. Their only meal is what they get at school if they're part of that program. And just being able to really feel that and recognize that this is just a short-term thing for me, and in 30 days, I'll be back to my normal schedule. But yes, so empathy, and also just when you're not constantly eating create space and time for other things. And so I do find myself more reflective, more able to, I feel, I call it my Ramadan high. Like I'm in a different zone sometimes when I'm worshiping, when I'm saying my prayers. I'm a lot more connected with God. And I remember a couple of years ago, being in a UMC church, I feel like I need to plug Reverend Wes Magruder of Dallas, and he fasted for 30 days, decided that he was going to...
He's kind of a crazy guy, though.
He is. He's definitely unique. Yeah. And there were people who supported his decision and others who were not so crazy about him doing it. But I just remember he blogged about it, and I think the blogs, for me as a Muslim who was fasting, it was really cool to be able to see a Christian's reflections going through the fast. And some of the things that he said he was able to, I remember this one particular thing, he said there's this, because you're not eating and you're not drinking and it creates that space, there's almost a hum that he felt like it was a reminder, the headaches even, when you, on the mornings when you just don't get your coffee, you've got a little headache by the end of the day. And even that was a reminder for him of the greater, you know, our greater cause. And it spoke to me in a different way hearing it from a Christian pastor than a Muslim who, we do tend to sort of just say, oh my gosh, I'm having such a hard day. We can't complain about it because, you know, it's part of our practice, but it's really hard to do. So, it is what it is, and I really do feel like, again, just like anything in Islam, there's no compulsion in Islam. There are Muslims who don't fast during Ramadan. And so it is, just as with anything, you choose.
Well, they do different things, right?
Or they
do something else.
I actually know Muslims who may just decide to give up water, or they give up food, but they drink water. That's not the way it's supposed to be, but, I mean, as with anything, you don't have to do anything. You have to decide to what you're going to practice. And so it's fascinating to be able to, I guess for me personally, to do it. And if you're physically unwell, my mom's diabetic, so she's no longer allowed to fast for Ramadan. When she first got diagnosed with diabetes, she said, oh no, I've been doing this all my life. It won't feel like Ramadan if I'm not fasting. And she tried. And though we discouraged it, and then after a couple of days, she was like, yeah, I don't think I can do this. And that is why you're not supposed to, Mom.
Well, we could join Wes Magruder and join you in, you know, in fasting at Ramadan. But, you know, I was thinking as I was preparing for this Sunday, I thought, we have this season in the church where we're encouraged to pray and to go to worship often and to fast. Anybody remember the name of that season? Yeah, 1, 2, 3?
Lent.
Yeah, Lent. Yeah, and it's I know in the Catholic Church, you know, they tend to make a pretty big deal about Lent, but in the Protestant churches, we don't. In fact, we almost kind of downplay it. We almost want to say, well, you know, it's kind of weird and all that. But, you know, listening to you talk about and others talk about Ramadan makes me think that we ought to be doing more with Lent, because there's a lot in our tradition that I think can deepen our faith in some powerful ways. Yeah. So thanks.
Yeah, actually, there's a hashtag called Muslims for Lent.
Really?
And,
my comment was just a lead into that.
And also there's a hashtag or a movement, I guess I should call it. The hashtag is just the way to let people know about the movement. Christians for Ramadan. And so it's sort of people from the Muslim tradition and the Christian tradition deciding to stand in solidarity with their brethren, with their cousins, as we would say, in the Abrahamic tradition, through their period of fasting. And several Muslims, I remember a few years ago, I decided to give up Coca-Cola during Ramadan. And I might have... Yes, I prayed and wanted to make sure I...
I'm so glad Jake Kimmer's not here.
Coca-Cola, which I have, that's my thing. I don't drink coffee as much as I drink that. But I might have started off too hard because it was really a struggle. And so though I'm used to fasting Ramadan where you're not drinking and eating anything for multiple hours, I had a harder time with Lent than I did with Ramadan. Because giving up something that you're so used to for 40 days was harder than being able to drink it at the end of the day.
We're going to have to wrap our time up. You're a delight. And
thanks for having me.
Gosh, I just have one more thing that I wanted to finish just to sort of wrap things up, if that's okay. I mean, I've often thought that, you know, just in your talking about that, about how, you know, your acquaintance with people who are in Christian traditions is pushing you to do things a little bit differently in your own faith and life. You know, instead of our differences dividing us and causing all this tension, all this strife, I mean, to me, that's a perfect example of how our differences maybe can encourage us to be better at what we do. So I'm encouraged by Sheikh Umar and my times with you all to be a better Christian, I think. And I just wish that it could be like that. But I did want to ask you, what are some ways that we can, you know, we've been trying to bracket out all of the stuff about Islamophobia and violence, and you see how hard that is. We haven't been able to completely bracket that out. It's out there. What can we do in this church and this congregation to support you all and to support the mosque?
Well, I love the banners. So that's a start. Just having a visual banner that supports Muslims and stands in solidarity.
So even though it was just a banner, it was good to have the banner.
It's a start, and I think it at least lets people know, especially because we're in the middle of a campus environment, Muslims who are young, 17, 18-year-olds who are for the first time away from home, to be able to see that sign, I think, really helps them feel more welcomed. And I think the next step of it is, I guess putting that to action. And I've had interfaith, I've had meetings with other clergy, other pastors, who said, well, how do we take that to the next level? If UMC downtown wanted to know what they could do to support us during Ramadan. And one of the things I said is, well, here's a list of Muslim businesses in town. If you would like to go and dine there, that's one way to support Muslims. But then also, really, I think it's more subtle. The day-to-day, if you see someone who is visibly Muslim walking down the street, I think even just a smile and a nod and acknowledging them and saying, if you really would like to, you could say assalamu alaikum, which means peace be on you. And I was replying that to some of the folks when we were doing the greeting, because that is how we say peace be on you.
Did you get it back from people?
I did. Yes, I was really impressed. and so just that day-to-day, if you're at the grocery store, or really if you witness someone being Islamophobic toward a Muslim person, maybe just stepping in. There's this great meme that's flying. I'm sorry, I'm way too much on social media. But that's going around where it says, if you witness someone being Islamophobic toward a Muslim man or woman, instead of jumping in and talking to the person who is the attacker or the person perpetrating sit in some way, engage the person who is who's a recipient of that, and talk to them and basically let them know, hey, I'm right here with you. Let me know what I can do to help you. And make eye contact with them, smile, let them know that they're in a safe space. And I think that's a lot harder to do than said, but even me personally, as a Muslim who doesn't wear the hijab, I feel like I have a privilege because I get to walk the streets without people necessarily looking at me funny. But when I see somebody who is a muhajaba, a woman wearing a hijab, who's walking down the street, I might just say, hey, do you want me to walk with you? Or, I've got my car right here, can I give you a ride somewhere? Now, that may be a little, you might not want to start with that. But I think just being compassionate, being a friend, being a neighbor, I say, you know, being a Muslim and in your tradition, being Christianly toward people. I think that's a really great start. It goes a long way.
Well, I think you can look at the faces in this congregation before you and behind you. You know, we appreciate the mosque. We appreciate the openness of the mosque and the times that we've had there. And we will do everything that we can to support you and to support students here, to be a safe space. If students need a safe space, to be compassionate and to do all of those things. Amen?
Amen.
And Sadia, I'm afraid we're going to have to close our time together, but thank you so much for being here with us today.